Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello and welcome to the Game Changers podcast, where you'll hear from trailblazing women in sport. I'm Sue Anstice, a founding trustee of the Women's Sport Trust charity and the founder of Fearless Women, a company with a powerful ambition to drive positive change for women's sport. Massive thanks to Barclays for once again supporting this series of the Game Changers, which focuses on fearless women in football, reinforcing Barclays' huge commitment to the beautiful game. In 2019, Barclays announced the largest ever commercial sponsorship in UK women's sport when the Barclays FA WSL became Europe's first fully professional women's football league. Along with this fantastic support for women's professional sport, Barclays also invested in establishing the Girls Football School Partnerships, with the aim of ensuring that all girls in England will have equal access to football in schools by 2024. My guest this week is Emma Hayes, MBE, manager at Chelsea Women. Having twice led Chelsea to the FA Cup and Super League double, once again this year, Emma's team won the Barclays FA WSL. It's a fascinating conversation where Emma talks very openly about her life, her career, and shares lots of advice for others hoping to be high-level coaches in the future. Just to flag, there's an occasional bit of background noise on this podcast as the house next door to Emma's had some building work going on while we spoke. It's not too disturbing, but just to let you know. I started our conversation by asking Emma where she grew up.
I grew up in Camden Town, and I went back there a couple of weeks ago, and I think I was just overwhelmed thinking about the impact Camden had on my life growing up, and influences, musical influences, punk influences, just our culture, diversity, the whole thing. Camden has played a huge part in who I am. And I think I actually said this to Joe Tung, that I'm certain because I haven't played the game at the highest level, that's what I learned in Camden that has allowed me to manage. It's allowed me to manage people, because you just, you know, it didn't matter what you did. I grew up in flats, literally off the high street. And my memories are really clear. I played football the whole time and run outs, and probably avoiding a few big kids who wanted to give me and my sisters a kick in every now and then. And I think all of those experiences have shaped me into the coach that I am.
And so you played, you say you played, you kicked out, you played as a girl.
Yeah, I grew up, I went to Parliament Hill School, and from a really young age I used to take the train on a Friday evening with my sister over to the JVC Centre at Arsenal, and we grew up playing for all the youth teams there all the way through till probably 16, and then progressed into the reserves. And I remember not having, well, I think I had a fallout with Vic at the time, because he was my coach. I've probably never had this conversation with him since then. But anyway, we had, just a disagreement about a few things. And then it didn't matter. I ended up going to play at Millwall for a bit, Barnet for a bit. And I just, everything I was doing, I was in pain the whole time. And I couldn't, and I remember Vic getting me a MRI, and I had no cartilage in and around my joint, my right ankle, and I'm left-footed. So every time I smacked my right foot to the ground, I couldn't absorb shock. So no matter what, I've thought about this a lot. it doesn't matter what my life in football would have looked like. It was so traumatic for me that I just couldn't play the game I loved. And I didn't know how to handle that as a teenager. But one thing I did do was got my head down. I had some good youth workers, good PE teachers who made me get my nut down and got enough to get into university. And I think that then set me on a different path.
Yeah.
So otherwise, I think I'd still be in Camden.
Were you a natural leader at school, do you think? So coaching and leadership qualities at an early age?
My PE teacher is still my mentor. And I I've asked her this question many a time, which was, and she's always really upfront about me. She was like, I mean, you were never going to make it as a football player, but you were always going to be a leader. And it's like, it's fine. I'm 43. You know what I mean? Feelings don't get hurt at this stage of my life. And she's right. I was always the one doing the community sports leadership awards, doing, you know, taking the kids' sessions in the summer. I worked for Camden Sports Development. I worked for Camden Play Centres and would work in the play schemes across the boroughs, worked for the sports development across the boroughs. I worked in a lot of bars and restaurants. And then I worked for a lot of my father's businesses. My sister said it to me yesterday. She's like, Emma, we've had to work since we were 13. Daddy never let us sit on the sofa. And I'm thinking the combination of all of them things, I've ended up where I should be, though I probably didn't see that at the time.
So when you stopped playing, was that really disappointing for you? Had you had aspirations to play for England or to progress through from?
It wasn't there. That didn't exist. We're talking about early 1990s here. So there's a handful of teams in and around playing the women's game, and I grew up playing against them, the Millwalls, the Charwens, the, you know, we didn't travel so far in youth football. The senior experiences at Arsenal or whomever, again, it was limited to a handful of clubs and all amateur. So it wasn't like I had aspirations and dreams to become a professional footballer. I had a dream to become Glenn Hoddle, but never a female equivalent. I think that in itself has been a key driver in why I've wanted to drive the sport, is I've wanted little girls to have a different dream than I did have. Because that actually, when if I ask my mum this question, she's like, I mean, it's all you wanted to do was play football. You just wanted to play football. And that's what I thought about. I didn't think about it in terms of a profession or things like that. I just wanted to do the sport I love doing. And only, I think, once I realised I couldn't do it and I didn't have a surgery that could help at that time. If I'd have injured myself now, there's enough surgery to do this sort of things, but there wasn't back then. Was I sad? Yeah, definitely. I remember being really volatile, I think I'd say, in my late teens. And my mum always says I was never really that disruptive, but I was always very independent, really determined. I left home really at 17, travelled Europe. Yeah, travelled Europe, then went straight to university. So I've always been really outward going, I like to explore different things.
Do you think that someone could be a coach, a great football coach, or any sport if you haven't played the sport yourself?
I get asked this question a lot, and I swear I ponder it a million times. I always say the same thing. Do you really have to have a lot of frequent air miles to be a good pilot? Do you have to be a fantastic student to be a great teacher? Do you have to be a really good patient with multiple surgeries to be a good surgeon? I just think about that. Do you have to be frugal with money to be a great banker?
Love it.
I think that answers the question. But I think in our profession, of course, experiencing something will offer insight, will provide a valuable reflection for players, because you've been in that arena, you can relate to them, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're a great leader.
No, I love that analogy. I'll be using that in the future, I'm too.
Yeah, I don't know why it sticks in our profession, though, that this whole process that I think kinesthetically, I think it's important within your coaching teams to have somebody who's played the game at the same level as the players. Somebody who's been in the arena is crucial. Is it a number one prerequisite to being a manager? No, I think it's desirable, but I don't think it's essential.
Excellent. And you mentioned that you got your head down and went to university, and obviously you studied politics at university. So did you ever think that's something you might return to one day? We could do with some strong leaders, some strong female leaders in this country right now, couldn't we?
Well, I don't know how I ended up doing European studies, Spanish and sociology. My real love is in language. I loved Spain, Spanish.
Right.
I liked government and politics, but always of different countries. I always enjoyed all my dissertations and research was always around things like the Basque terrorist groups or the world's largest stateless nation, the Kurds. I've always had a real interest in minority groups. I think I've always been interested in understanding how big state works in our society, how we fit into all of that. I've had a big interest in post-1945 European politics. Like, I'm boring myself listening to it. And did I think I'd end up on it? I think I can say this now. I never felt bright enough. I never felt confident. I felt that kid coming out of the council estate, like I was never good enough. So I think on one level, it took me until I got to university to take myself seriously as a student. Up until then, it was like, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. Got to uni and thought, I really like this and I really enjoy it, but I'm afraid of myself. I don't know how to do something which is completely out of my comfort zone and thrive in a place academically, which I never grew up in. So I feel like I've got unfinished business in that realm. I think as a result of developing an academic interest in that area, it taught me a lot about strategy and objectivity. Would I say they are two major components to who I am as a coach and a leader? 1,000%. Like learning manoeuvres that were carried out by an American army in the Iraq war. Have I taken that particular sneak manoeuvre into football? Yeah, I have.
Fascinating.
On so many levels, I wanted to work for the United Nations. I wanted to be a peacekeeper. I wanted to be a negotiator. As I said, I never felt confident enough in my own abilities to really go after it.
Interesting. How did you then find your way into football? What was your kind of path then into a football career from that at university?
Went to uni. All my pals at uni were bonkers and needed a bit of order and structure. And I was getting annoyed with them every week at training. And they were like, well, why don't you just coach the team? And I played and coached them all at once. So my dad and Vic helped me out. We took an Arsenal kit, and my team in Liverpool wore an Arsenal kit all the way through my uni years, which was always really odd playing in the Boosa Cup. I was always the minibus driver. I was always the one carrying the balls and the cones. So that should have been a huge bloody indicator then. But it wasn't. It still wasn't enough. And then I went back to Camden after university and started working with Camden Sports Development for West Euston Partnership. And I had a core task of setting up a football league in Regent's Park to break up a lot of the fights that were taking place between the Pakistani and the Bangladeshi communities. And that league is still going strong, and I believe it's about 4,000 players in it.
Wow.
So every Saturday on Regent's Park, there's those kids playing. Every time I look at that, I think I've played a massive part in bringing that to life. And a lot of the work was, again, working with just all disparate groups across the borough. And I enjoyed it, but it lacked competition. And I'm really competitive. And the guy I worked with at the time, Jeff, he said to me, why don't you go out to America and coach out there? I know some people. And boom, 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 just like that. 3 months later, I was working for Major League Soccer camps with £1,000 in the backpack. Sense of adventure. I went, sod it. I'm living it back home. I'm going. And I went. And that was that.
And when did you get your UEFA coaching licence? Was that before you went?
Yeah. I think I did that when I was in uni.
Is that when you went and then to New Rochelle and the college worked at?
No, I went to Stony Brook in Long Island and I worked with a soccer club out there. And from there, I then started with the Long Island Lady Riders. And that was a real unbelievable experience. I got to manage a team at 25, thrown in at the deep end, clueless, and having to manage my boss, who was also my goalkeeper. Huge learnings and huge mess-ups all at once. And without them, I don't know where I'd be. And from there, I went to New Rochelle to work for Iona College. I learned a lot then about the importance of community and working for a university or colleges in America. That whole scholastic experience and holistic approach to the development of the student athletes, I think I've taken with me. America's played a huge part in who I am, definitely. And that experience at Iona College, hands down, was my favourite.
Oh, wow. And what was it about it?
Yeah, the whole thing. I think the combination, you know, I've got football players that are training in the afternoon, going to classes in the morning, involved with shaping their whole lives around it and helping them, guiding them. I enjoyed the age range immensely. Yeah. I had a brilliant group of girls. We used to come up against huge opponents and we were like, it doesn't matter, we're going to beat them anyway. And how we ever did, I used to get like a 500 record, which is like just winning 50% of your games in America. And it was like winning the World Cup for that school. And we just had a ball. And they looked after me. The school looked after me. The players looked after me. It was just a really lovely 3 years. I was really sad to leave, but I got the call from Vic to come back home to assist him. And I was torn. It probably took me 3 months to make that decision.
And how long were you back at Arsenal for?
2 years. 2 years, came home, oversee the academy program with Kelly and Jane. And that was a great group of 16 to 19-year-olds. And then I coached the women's team of an evening and Vic managed the team and I coached them. And I've known Vic because he was my coach. So that was weird at first. You know, Vic and I have known each other a long time and I was there to do a job for him and he was a title he wanted to win desperately and we managed to win it in the first season I was there in the UEFA Cup. You know what, I was offered the chance to take over from Vic and I declined because I wanted to challenge, I wanted to improve. And I felt that if I just stayed in the league where there were guaranteed winners, yeah, it looked pretty on my CV, but I don't care about those things. I wanted to be pushed. And I had a decision to make between Chicago and St. Louis, and I'm so glad I went because Chicago is another experience that was impossible but crucial. I needed all of that setback, all of that disappointment, all of that effort that went into trying to put a team together there.
The new franchise.
Yeah, I mean, literally had to put a team together from scratch. And that was a whole new process that, from a learning perspective, is one that I took forward with me. I've always thought I've been able to build teams well, but I needed the setback at Chicago to do that. But beautiful city. What a lovely place. It was a good experience, really, really good experience. WPS was good.
Obviously, things didn't work out for you there. So did it make you question your own capabilities at all? Did you know it just...
Yeah, I cried a lot. I remember getting sacked and I was in a Starbucks, got sacked in a Starbucks. I didn't have my phone because I dropped it in the toilet that morning. And I asked the person who sacked me to lend me their phone because I just needed to get a lift out of there. She's like, you can't ring your assistant to tell her. I said, no, I promise I won't. I walked outside and I rang my assistant. And I said to her, listen, I've been sacked. And if they offer you the job, you take it. No. Don't you hesitate. She's like, what do you mean? Take the job. You progress. And she turned it down.
Oh, no. You're so loyal.
Oh, to a fault.
No.
You know what? I learned a lot about that too and the values that matter to certain people. And, you know, we've remained very close as a result of it. And she has no regrets about that. Yeah. That's the important thing, is her decision on that front. But I then went to South Africa. I jumped on a flight, went to South Africa, went to watch the World Cup with some vuvuzelas, went to see some friends down in Shark Bay or wherever it was, cried for a couple of weeks, partied for a couple of weeks, lost my confidence completely, went back to the UK, and I said to my dad, you know what, Dad, I'm going to set up an online business for you out of Covent Garden. And sat in Covent Garden and built an online business in foreign exchange.
Oh, wow.
And that family, well, I found it's our family business, but I built the online portion and content management systems in the background. So I had some really quirky goalkeepers that have worked for me over the years and taught me a lot about JavaScript and CMS writing. And I know.
Oh, that's so weird, isn't it? So then how did you end up then at Chelsea? What's the...
Not through looking. I wasn't looking for a job. A former player of mine, Laura Coombs, texts me. She was at Chelsea and she said, we need a manager. I've told them to ring you up. And I was sitting watching Mo Farah winning one of his races at home. And the phone call came through from the then chairman. And I remember thinking as he rang, oh, as much as I want to ignore it, that clairvoyant did say, this is where my future's going to be. So I said, I'll meet you at Cobham tomorrow. Drove to Cobham, walked on site, and I thought, oh, my God, there's so much potential here. This is ridiculous. I'd be foolish not to take this job. I didn't even ask about the job, the money, the salary. In fact, I worked very little for a long time. But my own choosing, because I kept with Covent Garden. And talk about an amazing marriage. I found a beautiful home in Chelsea, and, wow, lucky me.
And why do you think it is that they've embraced the women's game in a way that so many other top clubs haven't?
It's always important to get to the top people and find someone in that position who cares and is interested or is invested. I can speak at the time that both Emma Wilkinson, Bruce Buck in particular, were really keen, but they wanted to do it properly, not quickly, just properly, and built with a plan and a process and... The foundation sort of supplied the support that was needed. And I was always really cautious about building progressively. So everything that the players earned, I wanted them to feel like they've really earned it. And that's my upbringing. I mean, the minute I sense sport behaviour, rug's going. No, not for me. And I think it's a value. I know I can see the eye rolls from my players right now. They know how I feel about this sort of stuff. Like, we look after what we have, value what we have, and you will get more as a result of reward behaviour, whatever that reward is.
Absolutely. It does feel like the owner genuinely cares about the success of the women's team. Do you think that's important and that support affects the players as well?
The women's game has a debt of gratitude, in my opinion, to Roman Abramovich, because he, from the off, has always been really interested in it. And even when we saw each other in Israel,
I saw that,
loves the team, really enjoyed it. I remember sitting down during the game thinking, oh, God, we got to win today. The owner's here today. He's so excited. He's got his friends here. You know, I want to put on a good show for him, but it's pre-season. You never know what you're going to get in pre-season. And I saw him afterwards and he's just like, oh, he loves watching the team. And he loves all the Chelsea teams. He's such a big Chelsea fan as well as an owner. And that is hugely influential.
And we've obviously seen a kind of massive growth in profile in the last decade. So in terms of funding, what difference do you think the Barclays deal has made to women's football in the country?
I think it's made a huge deal, because once you get a huge brand name like Barclays associate itself with the biggest women's league, I'm always going to say this, in the world. I know the rest of the world hate me for that, but who cares? Means that you've got a marriage that is about the best. And I think being able to provide opportunities, not just at the top end, but the grassroots level and all of it, the coaching, the media, the podcast, and the whole thing, the community that surrounds it, to keep it alive, to keep it growing, to keep it progressing. The game needs that sort of investment, and it won't grow without that investment, because, like it or not, we've got 75 years to make up. So if we all think that people are going to start streaming in the door just because we're on a couple of TV stations, then we've got a lot of work to do. Give us that investment for the next 75 years at the same level that's been in the men's game, and then we'll see where we end up.
Fabulous. And in terms of crowds and people streaming in, how different do you think the crowds are for the Chelsea women's games versus the men's at the moment?
I always say to most people, if you drive your audience towards just daddy and daughter, you won't have a regular crowd. There's a whole group of people, male, females, single, not, that are coming to the games, but are consistently coming to the games because they love football. Not women's or men's, they love football. Two, they love the team. You can tell that. Like anything, you get drawn into something you really like about something. And I think our fans have seen it's a team that's just grown and grown and grown, and the fan base has grown with us. And I think a big part of that is because we're still in our infancy, but we've grown together. And we don't, you know, we give as much to the fans as they give to us. And they know that because I value the importance that they play in our winning. But also in return, it's important we keep giving back to the communities that are marching up and down the country for us week in, week out. And I think it's the joined up approach that has worked at Chelsea. I think everything from the top all the way down is become more coordinated with more time. And as a result of that, you get better marketing efforts, better commercial efforts, a better approach to the whole thing. And then my job is just to try and win.
It's easy, really. You've obviously got some wonderful young players in your squad. And actually, my daughter Daisy is really good friends with the extraordinary Emily Murphy. They were at school together. Clearly, some fantastic talent there. But how do you identify future stars? I guess, what qualities are you looking for beyond that sort of raw talent?
Well, without giving too much away, because I'm never going to give a yard to my competitor, it's a lot of years. I probably have a huge network of coaches that I've interacted with over a 25-year career. So even my next signing that's coming in, I can say that the relationship with her, one of her coaches at her point in her career or former assistants down that I play a part in getting a player. One, so network helps. Two, I care about the person. So I want to know about the person. I want to know who they are in hard times. I want to know who they are when it matters. I want to know about their upbringing. I want to know a lot about them. So that will form a part of it. And three is just, I've got a good eye. So I don't know how that's been trained, probably watching thousands of football matches over a long, long time. And also a clarity around what I'm trying to do. It's got to fit in. So you've got to get everything clear within your own culture around your objectives, your principles, your measurables, your key performance indicators, your whatever it is, all of that has to be clear before you can see whether a player can fit into that. And then it takes time. It really does. It doesn't, recruitment doesn't happen immediately, and could take a couple of years, maybe even longer, and patience play a part of it, but also keeping the finger on the pulse. Am I the person to pick the call up at 11:30 when I'm fast asleep if it's the agent I need to speak to? Yes, I am. Why? I don't like being second.
And are you seeing a difference in the skill and confidence of the young female players coming through today to where you were even in 2012, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Like the game in this country is a lot to be proud about. I think the strategies that have been put in place to provide bigger opportunities for players at younger levels is one of those. I think the exposures of our national teams. When I say that, I'm saying not just for England, but Wales, for Scotland, for Ireland, but also beyond that, because I'm certain that the top internationals playing in our league will play a huge part in the development of our top English talent. Of course, we've got to get the balance right to get enough opportunity for our English talent, but you've also got to be good enough. It's been a ball roll, a downward ball roll for the sport since 2012, and all of a sudden an industry started around our game, and I think that momentum is still going. That's why, for me, of course, COVID creates setbacks, but I have no doubt the sport will keep growing. I always like to look at things positively and optimistically. I think anything else becomes negative.
Yeah, it's almost self-fulfilling, isn't it, if people were.
Yeah, and we have enough of that in our sport. We need to, I'm not saying we don't have to analyse and critique and expect us to do that in the same way, but I think that there's such an important part that big clubs can play in the growth of the game. I know everybody always looks at it so negatively sometimes, instead of saying, listen, if I was to ask you to write down the 10 key things that a lot of big club investment has brought to the women's game, they will outweigh the negatives. And I think that the quality that's on the pitch, the product keeps improving, it will get harder and harder, and more teams will become competitive within it. But it takes time to do that.
Yeah. Absolutely. You talked a bit like about good kind of culture and values, and I know you've talked about that, a no-excuse culture. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, if, say, for example, you play a game and whatever, something happens in the game and a player can say to you, I know, but you didn't make that clear this week during in training, or nobody provided me with that, or I always look at my role as a facilitator. We're a service industry. I'm the contractor. I'm the head contractor. And I've got a ton of subcontractors working for me. And those subcontractors are all in place to put everything there so that the players just play. I'm not saying they don't have to think. And I don't want to spoon feed them through the entire process. But I want them to be in a position that they are responsible for their performance. Not me. They are. And they take responsibility because everything is provided. That's necessary, and it doesn't mean about giving them everything. It's about reflecting on the things that really, really matter and make sure that you listen to what their needs are and provide them, so that come game day you say, I've done my job, you cross the white line, it's your job now until half time.
And how would your staff describe you that work with you? I know I've kind of heard people talk about you having this really incredibly professional and demanding environment. How do you think they would describe you?
Oh, my God. Which one? Driven. I think driven comes up a lot. Adaptable. I never settle. I never sit still either. I'm happy to tell you how to do it, how to win, but I know that by the next time you play us, it would have already evolved into something else. It's evolutionary, our culture. Mm. I think the more and more I coach now, the more redundant I'm becoming, because I'm getting better at knowing how to draw situations from the players so that they are, through purposeful questions, they are in charge the whole time. So I think probably those things. I'm not stubborn. I'm not controlling either. I don't like micromanagement. I like to trust people, but if you do a crap job, I'll let you know.
In terms of being at Chelsea, you've been a real trailblazer at the club, tailoring the women's training in terms of menstrual cycles and that kind of bringing that into training. Why do you think that has been so important? Why do you think that is important?
Well, I think the menstrual cycle piece gets the most highlight when it shouldn't. And here's why. Women are not small men, and we both know that. So considerations around the differences between a man and a woman are one of the important considerations to make sure everybody can perform at their best level. That's just one consideration. There might be 12 or 13 others, from age of the player to injury history of the player to how many minutes they've played, to how explosive they are, to their playing position, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think one of the things we do really well is individualise around the player. What we've done around the menstrual cycle is educate people about things that they haven't been educated about, including myself. So, of course, every man listening to this is thinking, how traumatic can it really be once a month? Well, for some people, it's nothing at all. They can just come and go and it doesn't bother them. For others, it's absolute crisis. So it's recognising those that really, really struggle with it, how to give them the best strategies to cope with it. Much in the same way they might need the best strategies to cope with their sleep or their diet. So I think that's why I say the menstrual cycle is a piece of it. But what I think Chelsea have done, and I'm not saying that others aren't doing it, because they probably are, you know, in different ways, is I think we've made it an integral part of what we're doing and not something that's sat alone.
Yeah.
And for us, it's the ownership that we put on the players to know where they are within their phases, to know what they need to do in and around their phases so that they can perform. It's all about performance.
Yeah.
That they take responsibility for that. So I know for myself, if I'm in phase four, if I'm not doing certain things, then I'm going to suffer, much as I will do my strength training in phase, a lot of it in phase one, because I know I've got my best gains in that period. But that might not apply to another player on the team or another member of staff. I think we've been educated well. I think we've put it into practice well. And it's another part of something that goes towards top performance.
Excellent. Your little baby boy now, Harry, who's just two.
Mm-hmm.
How do you juggle motherhood with such an incredibly high-profile role?
With challenges every single day. And I think to deny it would be ridiculous, because I'd sell every woman and every mother or every parent short. I battle between the guilt of spending too much time with him and not with the team and around, and vice versa. I went back to work within 8 weeks of giving birth. I don't know what I was thinking. I think I was in a coma a whole year. But I felt like we'd won the double. Yeah, we'd won the double. And I thought I could just pick up where I left off. And then I realised, oh, my God, I'm so tired. And I just, I think the battling my hormones this last 2 years has been a huge struggle. And I think I've just about got it under control. I think COVID saved me in a lot of ways, saved my health. I really felt maxed out. I remember standing on the touchline at the Conti Cup final. I didn't sleep very well the night before, and I thought, I just want to lay down during the game. I'm so tired. I'm so tired, and I've got to put all in place, everything I've trained my brain to do to stay with it and to keep influencing the team and be at my best. So I've had to implement a lot of strategies to do that with sleep deprivation, with hormones that are all over the place, and also trying to learn to do something no book can teach you, which is being a parent, which is the hardest thing anybody will ever do. Running a team's so easy. So, yeah, I struggle like every woman, but I do my best. And I try to tell myself that, even if I don't always feel that way. And even if I probably cry more about being a crap parent sometimes than I do anything else, because if I feel like I've fouled not being able to get food in him that day, or I haven't connected with him in that day, that really troubles me.
Yes, yeah, motherhood. We're obviously in 2020, and I just want to talk a little bit about gender diversity in the Premier League and also the EFL. So I guess, where are all the women would be my question. Do you find that frustrating?
Well, I think I'll start with just diversity. Let's just start there. I can't wrap my head around that it's an industry that thinks, it's an industry that's about performance. So if you're talking about getting the best out of people, differentiation plays a part in that. So what might get the best out of you versus me requires different mastery. But also, everybody comes from different backgrounds, different experiences. So to think we are a profession that doesn't have a lot of diversity, whether it's more women, whether it's more BAME candidates, shock me still to this day. So that's the starting point, diversity in the first instance. And I wonder what it will take. And maybe the Black Lives Movement will play a part in that change, because I don't think it is going to be about gender diversity in the first instance. But I do think that I can relate. I can certainly relate to being a woman walking into all my coaching courses over the years, to walking into most football environments and feeling like I have just walked out of a spaceship or something. I can relate to that part. Do I think the football world is ready for change? Oh, that's a great question, one I don't think I can answer. I'm always hopeful and I'm always ambitious about progress in our society. And I am grateful for the levels of education that are starting to take place about how it feels to be on the outside. And I certainly take that on board around Black Lives Matter and how it feels to go into a room or walk down the street and feel instantly like you've been judged, whether it be your skin colour, whether it be, in my case, being a woman. Like, I can relate to a portion of that. But I tell you, I also reflected hard on this about where do I sit as a woman in football in relation to, and I've had a lot of these conversations with Chris Ramsey, one of my friends, about where women stand in all of this. And do you know what the realities are? I actually think, other than the football bubble, I wouldn't have experienced negative situations in my day-to-day tasks. I haven't felt that as a woman, if I'm honest. It's only in the football bubble do I feel like, God, I could be more experienced than that person. I've probably got more coaching experience. I might even have more qualms. I'm never going to get that job. So it doesn't matter whether John Herdman goes from Canada women to Canada men to Mark Sampson from England to Colchester. Why isn't Emma Hayes doing that, or Casey Stoney or Hope Powell? Like, why not? But I think about that more as an adult than I did about whether I was going to be a football player as a child. Yeah. Because that glass ceiling is probably harder to accept as an adult than it was as a child.
Yeah, I completely agree. And do you think it will change anytime soon? I know your name's bandied about a bit as the woman that will be there taking that first role within men's football.
Yeah, I've been given about 800 jobs, including on Football Manager. I've had people text me saying, you've just been sacked as the Bury manager or whatever. Have I? I haven't left North London. I think I don't think about it too much. And why? Because I know in this business you have to stay so present all of the time. And so I think only about the task that I'm doing. Am I hopeful in the future that I play a part in opening the door for other women in the men's game? Yeah, why not? If that ends up being what I look back on with my grandkids and I say, you know what? You know, Nanny did this. She kicked a few doors down in her youth. I'll be happy with that. It doesn't mean I have to walk into them, though.
I feel I can't really talk to you without talking about the lioness's role. Is that something?
Sorry, I can't help but do that every time.
That something? I mean, you've said in the past you've kind of got unfinished business at Chelsea. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I think I do. I want to achieve things. I think sustaining success is a challenge in itself. Winning things is hard. Sustaining it, that's harder.
Yeah.
So the competitor in me wants to sustain success. I don't like yo-yo years with winning. I don't like winning, losing, winning. And I need to master that. It bothers me. So I want to master that part. I like the day-to-day function. I like working with players every day. I think that's where my heart is at. And now I'll never say never for what my future is, but
My next question. And if you had a choice of managing the England men or England women, would you have a preference of those two?
Again, I don't think about international football. I love the club day-to-day work, and that's where my heart is. And
brilliant.
While I'm hugely honoured to be linked to that, I've never thought about it. People always say that to me, oh, yeah, you have. Surely you have. I'm like, look, I remember interviewing for England a few years ago, long time ago, actually. And I was with my mum in California, and we were driving up Route 1 from San Diego all the way up to Napa Valley. I was like, Mum, I've got an interview for England. She went, that's what you've always wanted, Emma, to get an interview for England. I thought, oh, it was just like getting a job. I know that sounds very odd, but when she said that to me, I was like, I laughed. I was like, oh, Mum, so funny. It's so funny. You know what you just said? She was like, I know, but you've always wanted to get the interview. I know, well, I've got that now. She's like, well, you've done it then. You've achieved. And it's hugely, I know my players talk about all the time playing in World Cups and how fabulous that is, and Euros and Olympics. Would I like to achieve that once in my career? Maybe, but not now.
Yeah. I'm going to finish finally. What advice would you give to young coaches who are coming in now and aspiring to have a success you've had?
I've thought about this a lot, and I've thought about, does a young Emma Hayes come back and get the Chelsea job again if it happened all over again? No.
Interesting, yeah.
So the accumulations of experience I've acquired, naturally, like you think about, I'm not 103, I'm 43, and I have got a lot of experience behind me. Would I have had that if I was doing it again? No. So the journey changes. Well, what does the journey then look like? I always think, if I'm hiring again my younger self, what will I be looking for? I like different journeys. I like to think that there's been an awful lot of challenge and maybe some misery and some suffering, but as a result of that, the learnings that come with it, diverse, I think really matters in those experiences. I think you probably have to network better than everyone. I will say, having gone through the process for a new assistant coach, I call it the CV culture. Wow, there's some unbelievably glossy-looking CVs nowadays. But actually being able to put that into practice is absolutely crucial. I think for women, what I will say is, don't sell yourself short and make sure you talk about football. So often I see on CVs, women talking about, well, I've got lots of good emotional intelligence and I can do this. That's important.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's important, but don't sell me on that. Tell me how you're going to beat the opponent. Tell me you're good enough to know how to do it. Because I tell you what, when I have to go up against Joe Montemurro or formerly Nick Cushing, look, football has largely been a man's world. I want to know, more importantly, that don't matter what they think about me, that's totally irrelevant. But they know my team's going to be prepared. And they know my team can have a strategy to beat them. And that's what I want to know about coaches is, do you have the strategy and have you developed that enough and are your football references strong enough that you can actually get to this level? And why do I think that matters? Because if you look at people like Nick or even Joe, they're coming from the men's game. So their references are strong. Their development pathway might be stronger. So we're going to have to raise the bar to make sure we stay with that. And that's something I've reflected on even going through a recent process.
I love talking to Emma, and I'm so grateful to her for such openness and honesty. It's clear to see why she's had such success, and I can't wait to see where her career takes her next. A big, big thank you to Barclays for their ongoing support of the Game Changers podcast, which enables us to take the stories of these amazing, trailblazing women to a whole new global audience. Thanks also to Sam Walker from What Goes On Media, who's been a brilliant executive producer for the Game Changers podcast. If you've enjoyed these podcasts, it would be fantastic if you could give us a rating or leave a review. You can also let us know what you think on social media, where you'll find me at Sue Anstis or The Game Changers on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. You can find out more about all of my remarkable guests from this and the previous three series at fearlesswomen.co.uk. The Game Changers. Fearless women in sport.